For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Late last week, the governor set a date to resume the second special session. It starts February 6th, the day after the legislature begins the regular session. The governor also calls on lawmakers to consider budget and policy issues put forth by business and civic leaders known as Step Up Oklahoma. Ryan, why resume a special session rather than just doing the work in the regular session?
Well, you know, it's so nice they wanted to do it twice. Yeah, the first one worked out so well for everyone. Let's try that again.
No, absolutely. Why not?
Absolutely. I think, you know, because the legislature in this current session that they're dealing with, the session that's going to kick off in February, the regular session, is dealing with next year's budget. It's looking forward, and these special session items are really looking backwards. They're trying to fix a hole that previously existed. And so I think, you know, dividing them up so that the legislature can really look at that retrospective work and the prospective work in two different ways. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not that actually makes sense, because ultimately anything that they do in the special session is going to have an impact, hopefully a positive one, on the budget negotiations moving forward with the regular session.
Neva.
I think that's right. I mean, we're in this kind of this continual loop. I mean, we can't get out of it. And I think that the frustration is across the board. I mean, the governor basically, I think, saw this as an opportunity to see this new proposal, get it on the table. I mean, there seems to be a lot of discussion about let's move quickly. I mean, the hope is that there'll be a vote early and within the first couple of weeks and try to resolve these past issues so they can look forward. That may be very wishful thinking, and at least from all appearances right now. I mean, we're already seeing kind of the skids come off and all of these plans. Everybody's now posturing, targeting, you know, seeing who's going to be in, who's going to be out. So I think it's still a very difficult course. But under all of that, I mean, we are seeing, you know, a few glimmers. I mean, when you look at least the $66 barrel oil versus what they had projected and made a lot of their calculations on 52 or 53 or whatever it was. I mean, there are some things that are going to make that budget hole not quite as extreme if they can efficiently deal with it and move forward, and time will tell.
And some of the dynamics that have changed since that original special session, and I think Neva's right, it is wishful thinking, but it does create this timeline where it could be expedited. You know, they could act on these things, and there's a sense that we need to do this now. We can't wait until May, and we adjourn sine die in May with this new regular session that's about to come up. The other thing that's changed is that we're beginning to see a growing number of folks across the political spectrum admitting that we've got this problem, that we've got this structural budget deficit, that we need to have serious revenue plans to bring those things in. And I think that the Step Up plan is a good step in the right direction. It had a huge media rollout. It was the benevolent billionaires and their millionaire friends that did this. It's good that they've got out there. I think that some of it, you know, we shouldn't just say that it is pure benevolence, because I think part of it is that they're trying to get ahead of the state question that would raise gross production tax up to 7%. I think that there are some questions, as David Blatt at the Oklahoma Policy Institute raised, about how they've structured those income tax increases that they've got built into that, the lack of a capital gains deduction, some of the other things in there. The plan itself is noteworthy, and I think a good conversation starter, but the devil's in the details. We'll see how much that begins to unravel over the next 2 weeks.
That's right. And when we see the details, I mean, is it energy and wind, or is it one or the other, you know, in the mix? The cigarette tax question, I mean, are we still at an intractable $1.50 conversation, or is it going to be half that, which might be more achievable at a time when, even when you look at the statistics, ironically, you know, I saw statistics that showed that we had a 7% drop in Oklahoma in smoking, and it was really because they were going to alternatives rather than they were having success with the cessation through the TSET and other programs. So, I mean, you've got that. Then you had this infusion in the discussion about the gambling component. I mean, so that kind of brings the tribes into the mix, and clearly there are billions that potentially are at play if that were to get serious consideration. So I think in the midst of all of that, what gets lost, it seems like, at least in the initial discussion, are the reform questions. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much focus on, at least at this point, even among lawmakers, less conversation about the reform aspect, which clearly the public says has to happen, than what we're talking about just on the budget side.
And on those reforms, the most important of those reforms, I believe, is the one that would reduce the threshold that the legislature has to reach in the number of votes right. necessary to raise taxes, raise revenue. There's a proposal right now to move that to 60% off of the three quarters necessary right now.
Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett takes the lead in polling of Republican candidates for governor. A Sooner poll has Cornett at 24%, with Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb with support of 18% of those surveyed. Most surprisingly, however, is finding 40% remain undecided. Neva, your thoughts on these results?
I'm not totally surprised. I mean, even though we are 11 weeks away from filing, we're only 21 weeks away from the primaries. I mean, we're on a fast track now. I think we're just seeing these campaigns really kind of start to step it up. And early on, even in these polls, I mean, we're going to see a lot of a very fluid environment. I mean, we saw that in the presidential primaries last time. When you get crowded fields, multiple candidates, none with, you know, meteoric name ID, but some have pockets. I mean, you know, Mick Cornett has the luxury of having been the mayor of Oklahoma City and has high name ID in that congressional district. You look at his numbers in Tulsa, he's a virtual unknown. So there's still a lot of room for all of these folks, and I think the breakout question is with Todd Lamb and Mick Cornett is, will one of these other folks become the third player in the mix, and who will that be? Will it be Stitt? Will it be Richardson? I mean, that remains an open question.
And I want to get to Democrats in just a moment, but what do you think about these numbers for the Republicans?
You know, I was kind of surprised to see Cornett come out as strong as he is. And, okay. you know, I think that, and I say that because the Republican primary electorate is a much more conservative electorate than the general election, for sure. And it's more conservative than the electorate that's put him in the mayor's position for, you know, many terms in a row. And so I was kind of surprised to see among Republican primary voters that he had that initial support. My talking point on this all along is that if Mick Cornett had run as an independent and not in that Republican primary, that he had a strong chance at becoming Oklahoma's first independent governor. And I think he's going to have some stumbling blocks moving forward. It's worth noting that this is an incredibly small sample size for a poll. So it's difficult to draw a lot of real hard and fast conclusions from this, especially whenever you start to try to break it out geographically around the state. The sample sizes there get even smaller, so the reliability, I think, goes down a little bit. But, you know, 40% undecided, the campaign really hasn't started. It started among fundraisers. It started among consultants. It hasn't started
any television ads.
No TV, no mail. Nobody's knocking doors yet. Nobody's really had to take a position. And in a crowded field like this, it's inevitable that people are going to start throwing some punches.
And so what you're really getting is just the baseline name ID. You're getting just a name that someone has heard versus names that they haven't heard at all. So I think you're right. You have to take this at least as a marker. It's clear. Right. I mean, it is a marker in the total scale of what we're going to see between now and the June primary. But I would agree with you, Ryan, and we're still very, very early. And Drew Edmondson on the Democrat side has the same advantage with name ID, having been on the ballot, having been better known than any of the other folks that are out there either seriously running or still, you know, maybe thinking about running.
Plus, he's in Edmondson, which is also,
exactly.
you know,
that, yeah. in yeah. Oklahoma, an yeah. Oklahoma political name.
He's got 40% of support compared to 27% for former State Senator Connie Johnson, but still in the Democrats, 35% undecided. So there's still a lot of wiggle room for either candidate.
Well, and we had one of the major candidates in that primary drop out. Scott Inman dropped out. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of his supporters who I think are in limbo right now, thinking, you know, where do they go? What's going to excite them about this campaign? And which candidate, whose camp are they going to find themselves in at the end of the day? That's a big question. I think more likely the Inman voters will go over to Edmondson votes. But like Neva said, you know, what we're looking at right now is, do you recognize this name?
Right.
And Inman and Johnson are not recognizable names statewide as
right.
opposed to Edmondson. I mean,
right.
even if Inman were still in the race, he might have had, like Cornett, a slightly higher name ID in the Oklahoma City metro area just because of his time in the public eye here being this home base. But beyond that, I mean, it's a struggle in 77 counties statewide to begin to develop name ID and traction in a statewide race, and I think we're seeing that in these numbers.
Meanwhile, you've got some others, Kevin Stitt, Gary Richardson, Gary Jones, who are all less than 10%. What do they need to do to try to vault over these the names like Cornett and Lamb?
Well, I think the question is, Stitt appears out of the list that you mentioned. I mean, is the one that has said that he will put personal money in, has put personal money in, fairly significant amount so far, and has shown some fundraising capability. You see some of these other folks, I mean, they're going to struggle. They have an isolated base of hardcore support, but it's small. These are single-digit campaigns right now, and to even break through and become a factor in a primary with the hope of getting into a runoff, I mean, that's a long stretch to get there.
Well, and those folks are going to have to, if you're raising money right now, that's what these numbers really talk to. They talk to donors. And if you're in a single-digit campaign, it's really hard to go in and say, you need to give me money so we can get this deal off the ground, because, you know, donors want to invest in winners. Right. And, you know, with somebody like Stitz, who's got his own money, he can transcend that and maybe get himself into that group of three.
And so does Gary Richardson, having put $1 million in. And interestingly enough, one of those folks, or, you know, someone in that second tier right now, just when you look at the normal breakout, they are going to become a factor in a runoff, because at some point, number one or number two in a runoff is going to need number three or number four or some combination of those votes to get them the nomination ultimately.
There's going to be, I think, some interesting side issues over on the Republican primary of how those candidates begin to distinguish themselves on the issues. If you look at the Democratic primary, if you go to an event right now where Senator Johnson and former Attorney General Drew Edmondson are speaking, in large part, they sound like the same candidate. You know, they have a lot of the same messaging. They agree on a lot of the same points. At some point, there's going to have to be some distinguishing positions that they take. It'll be interesting to see what those look like moving forward. And the same over in the Republican primary as well, especially with Mick Cornett, who as mayor took a lot of moderate, if not, you know, kind of liberal positions on some social issues, and some of the folks that support him.
And taxes.
We'll see how that actually, how his positions there may evolve, or how they come back as
well. The interesting thing with Cornett also is that Tom Lamb came out and basically said, you know, not for taxes. And then now we see Cornett kind of moving into that same positioning. And I think that has to be reflective of, I mean, these folks are seeing their own internal polling. They're seeing what's going on among their donors, among their supporters. And that does begin to kind of draw some distinction. I mean, now Stitt, who early on appeared to be more favorable to the revenue, you know, the revenue measures and that side of the ledger. I mean, will he stay there or will there be some more movement? Those things are now key pieces in, I think, Republican primary voters deciding who they're going to vote for in June.
A Sooner poll shows Oklahomans aren't happy with their state government. 58% of those surveyed have an unfavorable opinion of Governor Fallon, and with 57% having an unfavorable opinion of the legislature. Neva, while Fallon isn't running for election, most of the lawmakers are. Should incumbents be concerned?
Well, it's one of these questions. I mean, Congress has terrible approval numbers, and yet most people still like their congressmen. Right. So the same, you know, maybe there may be a little more push on legislators right now because they've been so in the public eye, and there's been so much focus now for, you know, nonstop. I mean, this entire past year, I mean, the whole discussion on the budget and the shortfall and teacher raises and, I mean, the on and on and on litany of issues that have been out there have really started to, I think, beat some of these legislators up back in their districts. But will it be enough to have some wholesale landslide turnover? I think that's really questionable. I think they will have to get back in their districts and make their case, but that's always, you know, that's always what we talk about in campaigns.
Ryan.
And, you know, the poll talks, I think it speaks volumes about the information level among the electorate right now, because among, you know, just generically, you have kind of equal blame among the governor and among the legislature, and equal blame in the legislature among Republicans and Democrats. And I think that if you start to, and the poll even talked about this, if you talk to folks that it says has a higher education level, what I read that to be is folks that are maybe a little bit more informed about, you know, listening to the deep tracks of the state legislature instead of the hits. And, you know, so when you look at that, Republicans get a little bit more of the blame. The governor comes out looking a little bit better than she does right now. I mean, frankly, Neva's right. people that when you talk to them about their state legislator, their incumbent that's representing them, they're probably going to like them a little bit more than they do as the body as a whole. And they're going to recognize that person. They don't recognize these other people. Most Oklahomans don't recognize Speaker Charles McCall. If Governor Fallon and Speaker McCall robbed a bank, the witnesses would say that the culprits were the governor and some guy.
And some guy.
And that's some guy was with her. And, you know, he's Speaker of the House, but most people don't know that. And so there's this generic blame that's cast. And what I think that spells out for Democrats in particular, in this year where everyone seems to think that incumbents are in more trouble than they've ever been, that the midterm elections, even in Oklahoma, could be problematic for a lot of Republican incumbents, that they still have a hill to climb in letting the voters know why they believe that the Republicans are to blame for the budget crisis that the state of Oklahoma has found itself in. And that's a tall order.
Yeah. And I think that is a tall order, because it can't just be about everything is bad and it's all on their watch. There have to be plans and solutions and something put forward to give a contrast. And I think that's going to be the real threshold for any candidate, whether they're running against an incumbent in a primary or whether they're running in a general election. There has to be something beyond just, you know, kind of throwing everything at them and saying that they are the problem and then not talking about anything about the solution.
And regardless of your message, you have to get out there and knock the doors.
Yeah.
A story which dropped this week might not help the House's favorability rating. House leaders are coming under fire for giving $127,000 in raises to 14 employees. This includes a $20,000 raise or 30% increase to its senior staff attorney. Ryan, your thoughts on this news?
You know, I think that these things are always difficult pills to swallow for the public. They look at that, especially people that are living paycheck to paycheck, and they hear that somebody gets a 30% pay raise. That seems, that's totally out of the norm for almost every other Oklahoman. But at the same time, that 30% increase, if you look at it, really brings that person into what's competitive for the marketplace for an attorney of that tenure and that seniority and that experience level. And if you want to hire quality people, if you want to retain quality people, you got to pay them what the market says that that position is worth. And you know, rather than, and I've said this before, where rather than attacking these pay raises, I just would ask that the House leadership, whenever they hear from the public employees in the state of Oklahoma, when they hear from teachers in the state of Oklahoma, that they recognize that we've got to pay them the market rate as well. You know, we're hemorrhaging folks to other states. We're pushing people out of professions where we desperately need their talents and their expertise. And instead of throwing rocks at the House, let's just say, all right, well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We need to apply that same logic to other public and employees and teachers.
Neva.
I agree with Ryan. I mean, there's a rub here, but the reality is when you have staff members that have great institutional knowledge, they have been there, they know the ins and outs, they have the expertise that's needed to be able to make the trains run on time, so to speak, within the building, then if you've got someone that's the chief clerk in the House and they get kind of stolen away from another agency, and how can we suggest that they wouldn't go if they get some significant increase versus where they are and they're not getting any increase at all? So it is just, it's the marketplace. I mean, we view the marketplace in state government with employees differently than we do in the private sector, clearly, and the public reacts differently, but it's still inside baseball. I mean, this is a story that comes up virtually every year. Last year we had a similar story, similar type deals. I mean, we don't hear about how either the House or the Senate internally kind of deal with their, with their staffing and their issues. I mean, and there's disparity. I mean, if you have on the Senate side staff that get an annual cost of living raise and yet their EAs haven't had a raise in 10 years, I mean, we're always going to have these disparities and discrepancies, and I think it makes for a story, but it's really, we have to keep it in context of just where that is versus the bigger picture.
And in the market itself, when we look at these state employees, and I think that they recognize when they walk into these jobs that part of their compensation is the public service. They're giving back to the state, they're giving back to their communities and the people and their neighbors, but that doesn't mean that they should have to take a vow of poverty to go work for the state. And when you graduate from law school and you want to be a lawyer, this senior staff lawyer that's getting this could command a six-figure salary at some of these law firms. But they give that up. But that doesn't also mean that we have to be competitive in some regard. But we've also got a lot of state employees out there that have gone decades plus without any sort of a meaningful raise, and we're losing them left and right. Yeah.
The Oklahoma Commission on Opioid Abuse provides 31 recommendations to lawmakers to cut down on abuse of the prescription drug. Recommendations include increasing money for drug and mental health courts, paid for possibly with a tax on opioids. Other recommendations include limiting the drug for minors, tracking fatal and non-fatal overdoses, along with more registration and education. Neva, do you see any hopes of these recommendations getting passed in this tough budget year?
I do. I mean, not all of the recommendations certainly are tied to dollars.
Right.
And so I think those that aren't certainly, have the possibility for much swifter action. But even those that do have a price tag attached, I think in the climate we're talking about and the seriousness of the issue and the fact, as one person said during that news conference, this is an issue that now affects virtually every Oklahoman. What family, what individual has in some way not been touched directly or somewhat indirectly by the issue. So I think it's timely. I think Attorney General Hunter has done an excellent job of leading the way on this. And I think there's great hope and expectation that many of these 31 recommendations that they've worked on the last 6 months will actually become a reality and soon.
Ryan.
Well, yeah, I think that there are a lot of good recommendations. There are some of those things we already see. I mean, we go to the doctor. Most folks, when they go to the doctor, they get an electronic prescription sent over to their pharmacy. And I think, moving all prescriptions to that system is a good way to reduce on fraud and counterfeit prescriptions. Now, is that a huge problem? I don't think it's as big as folks think that it is, but it's an easy way to do that. And in terms of cost, it's pretty low. Now, creating some taxes to place on distributors. Now, those are things that will get passed on to pharmacies that ultimately get passed on to customers. And so, I mean, if we're thinking about how to pay for this stuff, making medication more expensive is probably not the best way to go about doing it. The Good Samaritan laws, where if you see somebody overdosing, you call in, you give yourself some criminal liability protection there. That's a great idea. That needs to happen yesterday. Increasing the number.
They tried to do it last year.
It should have happened. Yeah. And I think that this year something like that's poised to pass. Giving pharmacists greater access and encouragement to give folks that are getting opioid prescriptions overdose reversal drugs so that they've got access to that and education on how to use it. And then, some of these things like, using medical-based treatment options for pain medication and pain management, those are good options, but they're also really expensive. And so how do we pay for that? It's difficult to tell somebody, especially a patient, we're going to give you on this, this medically managed pain management regimen that's safer, but it's also much more expensive than the opioid drug that you're getting access to that does the exact same thing for you, but is much more dangerous. Right. And so there are some costs associated here, but there's also a lot of good steps here, like Neva said, that don't cost anything at all.
Well, and limiting the prescriptions for young people under 21 to 7 days. I mean, that's one that I think will kind of light up the board for a lot of folks because they know the immediate impact that'll have. I think the criminalizing fentanyl and the issue of the trafficking of that and the fact that that it's such a significant problem. If you can die from an overdose with as little as 3 milligrams, I think the report said of that. I mean, that's an issue that clearly needs to be addressed and moved on quickly.
And the other concern, of course, is the last time the legislature really tried to crack down on a drug, we all now have to go over the counter. We can't get Sudafed over the counter because of the crackdown on meth. Is there concern that trying to crack down on opioids is going to negatively impact the people who are just taking it? The regular citizen is.
I think the trade-off is, I mean, the scope of the problem itself and the fact that it has to be addressed, and that means there are going to be things that people don't necessarily like when they go to their favorite pharmacy and try to get something. But in the bigger picture of how it curbs and addresses this huge problem out there, I think that's the thing that the public's going to have to come to terms with. I think that's going to be the reality.
And I think that what it means also is that we need to have a much more open and honest conversation about drugs and drug use and who drug users are, and that just because somebody uses drugs doesn't make them a bad person. Just because somebody doesn't use drugs doesn't make them a good person. And that, this idea that's been caught up that drug use is somehow this moral choice, and it's just really not. And we've put it into this criminal justice system for far too long, and we've sidelined public health care officials and public health experts. they're coming back to the table now. You know, Neva said, you know, the criminalization of fentanyl trafficking, it's already illegal. So don't, if folks are listening, don't think that you get a free pass on that one. It's some free legal advice for you. Don't traffic fent. It is illegal. But, you know, I think that if we do get to this point where, you know, I think a lot of folks right now exist in the shadows because we have criminalized their health issue. And by taking it out of the criminal element, moving it into the public health arena, where medical professionals and patients can have open and honest conversations about pain and pain management and drugs and drug addiction, we're going to save a lot more lives than just, you know, trying to, you know, continue to prosecute this broken war on drugs, which the people of Oklahoma this summer will have an opportunity to do a big step in opioid overdose treatment and reduction. And that's passing by state question 788 that would create a medical marijuana program in the state of Oklahoma, which studies have shown in states that have that a reduction in opioid overdose deaths.
There you go. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.